Now available at the Academic Agency. Sharpen your analytical mind and your argumentation skills with Foundations of Logic. The course draws on the ancient wisdom of traditional logic that students learned for over 2,000 years, from the time of Aristotle through to the medieval schoolmen, right down to the 20th century. Sign up now for a free preview lecture.
This is the third and final part of my trilogy of videos critiquing libertarianism, and in which I seek to explain its abject failure against socialism for at least the past 100 years. I'm afraid by necessity this one will be much longer than the others. Before continuing, I think it is worth recapping my arguments thus far. In the first video, I argued that the core reason that libertarianism fails against socialism is because it shares the same goals. It accepts the socialist premise variously, by which I mean, depending on the flavour of libertarianism, that society aims at maximising equality, that it aims at material prosperity, or that it aims at freedom. This is because they share a common root in Enlightenment values. In the second video, first I responded to criticisms that libertarians and socialists define freedom differently by collapsing the famous distinction between positive and negative liberty made by Isaiah Berlin through the slightly less famous argument of Gerald C. McCallum Jr. Then I went a step further and argued that libertarianism has acted as a handmaiden to socialism by helping to repeal old conservative laws which help to maintain tradition, which is actually in the spirit of liberalism, which then paves the way for socialists to impose new illiberal leftist laws that mandate and compel a new status quo, essentially by banning the old conservative value. I argued that the net effect of this is that libertarians serve to bring about conditions in which there is an increase in degeneracy, which produces more socialists who then lock in, so to speak, by law, the new status quo. Formally, I might write that argument as follows. Degeneracy creates socialists. Libertarianism creates degeneracy. Therefore, libertarianism creates socialists. I then went on to argue that although in theory both libertarians and socialists have as their stated goal the total destruction of the nation state as we know it, in practice they have served as handmaidens to each other, essentially the useful idiots of those in power, by which I mean the oligarchs of international finance. Note, for the purposes of these videos, the terms liberalism and libertarianism are interchangeable. I use libertarianism chiefly for the benefit of American viewers. My critique includes the entire spectrum of libertarian thinkers, from Hayekians who accept a limited welfare state, minarchists who wish for a night watchman state, and anarcho-capitalists in the Rothbardian tradition. This may seem harsh, but just as communists failed to have their revolution in the USA, but did succeed in trashing just about every social norm people held dear 70 years ago, libertarians failed to abolish the Fed, but did succeed in legalizing weed, deregulating the movie industry and pornography, and helping to make said oligarchs less accountable to the people over whom they rule. However, in response to many comments, I must put aside Hans Hermann Hoppe for one moment. Hoppe is a very peculiar thinker who stands apart from the broad currents of libertarian thinking, and I must deal with his specific arguments in a separate video. I will also return to him later on in this one. For now, I will say, however, that I don't believe that Hopperland is going to happen anytime soon, but that is beside the point. With this preamble over, I want to go a step further again. In the first video, I discussed general social aims and first premises, In the second, I focused on the moral effects and practical consequences of libertarianism's continued failed opposition to socialism. In this video, I want to think about libertarianism, whether in its highest and strongest and most consistent form, which I'd say is in the tradition of Ludwig von Mises, or in its inferior, empirical or positivist form embodied in someone like Milton Friedman, as being blinded to many important aspects of life by Enlightenment rationalism, which has buried in it what I will call, for the purposes of ease of understanding, a hidden egalitarianism. The basic unit of analysis in libertarian thinking is the individual. Now, long-time viewers of this channel will know that I have stressed constantly that individualism does not mean John Wayne going it alone against all odds. It means methodological individualism, which is simply the recognition that only the individual, as opposed to groups, can act, and therefore it must be our smallest unit of analysis. However, there is in this method a kind of flattening of human life. In the crudest cases, such as Jeremy Bentham or John Stuart Mill, the individual becomes a util for whom happiness must be maximized. In the positivist economics of the Chicago School, the util becomes the rational, self-interested agent of game theory, in which people follow material incentives. In the Chicago School, of course, thinkers are much more careful. But there is still, even in the work of a genius like Mises, the concept of satisfactions. As I have stressed many times, a quote-unquote satisfaction can be material or non-material, but it is captured as data by revealed preference, which is to say, after the fact of action itself. However, while this Austrian conception is much more nuanced than those of the other schools, it still has the effect of flattening satisfactions as being equal in prospect, by which I mean, in the radical value-free subjectivism of Mises, buying a cheeseburger from McDonald's carries the same ethical weight as a monk who chooses to spend his time deep in meditation instead. These are both simply revealed preferences. It is not for economics to say anything more. However, it strikes me that in these attempts to be value-free, there is in fact an implicit telos, which is to say end goal, smuggled into the analysis. In Bentham and Mill, this is explicit. It is to maximize the happiness of the most individuals. In the Chicago rational choice models, the concept of happiness has been replaced by the more mechanical concept of self-interest driven by material incentives. In the Austrian conception, the normative ideas of happiness or material gains are replaced by the more neutral and subjective satisfactions. But nonetheless, there is the implicit idea that a society in which the subjective satisfactions of the most individuals are fulfilled is more desirable than one in which those satisfactions are left unfulfilled. Let us study this pair of images. Now, a conservative thinker like Carl Schmitt would immediately tell you that what we see here is a classic example of the friend-enemy distinction, which is at the heart of politics. This is clearly a war, but war is simply politics by another name. A strongly Christian conservative thinker, someone like Hilaire Belloc, sees an existential struggle between his own religion and that of a heathen other. In fact, Belloc lamented the fact that the Crusades had not been won by the Christians. He said, and I quote, "The story must not be neglected by any modern who may think in error that the East has finally fallen before the West, that Islam is now enslaved, to our political and economic power, at any rate, if not to our philosophy. It is not so. Islam essentially survives, and Islam would not have survived had the Crusade made good its hold upon the essential point of Damascus. Islam survives. Its religion is intact. Therefore, its material strength may return. Our religion is in peril. And who can be confident in the continued skill, let alone the continued obedience, of those who make and work our machines? There is with us a complete chaos in religious doctrine. We worship ourselves. We worship the nation. Or we worship, some few of us, a particular economic arrangement believed to be the satisfaction of social justice. Islam has not suffered this spiritual decline. And in the contrast between our religion's chaos and Islam's, religious certitudes still strong throughout the Mohammedan world, lies our peril. Now that speaks for itself. Let us return to the image. Other thinkers of a more Nietzschean bent would see in this an essential masculine vitality and heroism. People prepared to die for a higher purpose, bigger than themselves. Now, to all of this, what can the liberal or the libertarian say? Well, first, can they really draw the friend-enemy distinction or even recognize that these are two fundamentally different groups of men with fundamentally opposed beliefs about the world? Strictly speaking, if we are to hold them to their own tenets, they can see only individuals. Here we see a group of individuals. In the liberal mindset, it is easy to imagine the thought, what a waste of life. Are the satisfactions of these individuals really being served by killing each other? This is senseless. Why don't they trade? What is gained by all of this? This is a suboptimal allocation of scarce resources which have alternative uses. These sorts of wars are what silly medieval people did who did not have our enlightened insights. Of course, now we know better. Some liberals might even look at this and lament something along the lines of, this is what religion does, it divides people. Or perhaps, this is what ideology does. What you are hearing in this imagined stream of consciousness I'm giving you is a modern, scientific, materialist mindset struggling to come to terms with the notion of a higher purpose and transcendence. Now, there is something of this in what J. Mortimer Adler calls the 20th century delusion. Let me quote him. A cultural delusion is widespread in the 20th century. The extraordinary progress in science and technology that we have achieved in this century has deluded many of our contemporaries into thinking that similar progress obtains in other fields of mental activity. They unquestioningly think that the 20th century is superior to its predecessors in all the efforts of the human mind. Some of our contemporaries make this inference consciously and explicitly. They do not hesitate to declare that the 20th century has a better, a more advanced, and sounder solution of moral and political problems, that it is more critically penetrating in its philosophical thought, and that it is superior in its understanding of, and even in its wisdom about, the perennial questions that confront human beings in every generation. If we return to our image, the mindset that thinks that the Crusades were backwards, or savage, or less civilized, or a good example of how we have overcome the problems of the past, would be guilty of this. And there is at least the spirit of this progressive hubris in libertarian thinking, which seeks to avoid war at all costs and to maximize trade. But I ask you, does the mindset that looks at this image and sees only individuals represent a significant advancement over the mindsets of Schmitt or Belloc or Nietzsche? And is it necessarily, quote-unquote, more rational? One thing that is certain, by looking at this image and seeing only individuals, there is an egalitarian leveling. There is the basic assumption that the men we see here are fundamentally similar enough that they put down their swords and trade goods for mutual benefit. And beyond that, that each one of these men has a personality, hopes, dreams, desires, and so on. In a different time and place, in a more enlightened age, so to speak, these hopes and dreams may have been satisfied. Maybe Ahmed here would have been better off sitting at home, eating a takeaway, and watching Married at First Sight. Certainly, his life expectancy would have been longer, and his daily nutritional intake would have been higher. Surely that's progress. I have laboured this point, but I hope you can see the difference between a mindset that sees the material world and the intellect subordinated to a higher purpose, and a mindset that sees the material world as primary, with man as a slave to his passions, a kind of glorified animal who can use his intellect to make better stuff. In this second worldview, higher purposes are just puff and ideology, the stuff of propaganda and silly superstition. Let me list the ways in which libertarianism has exhibited a hidden egalitarianism thus far. First, in failing to recognize the Schmittian friend-enemy distinction, it artificially levels the field of politics into a negotiation between individuals. The failure to recognize an enemy as an enemy means that you use tactics on them, such as reason, debate, discussion, compromise, trade deals, and so on, that you would use with a friend. This is fatal when they recognize you as an enemy, but you see them only as an individual. And this is likely at the heart of why libertarian arguments get nowhere at all with socialists who do recognize this distinction. A second way in which the libertarian worldview is egalitarian is in its treatment of transcendent beliefs as mere ideology. This is the Belloc point, where he recognizes the Christian and an outgroup, the heathen. The liberal mindset can only recognize competing ideological beliefs that have an equal weighting. They merely exist as ideology as such. And this is radically leveling in itself. And this is somewhat shared with the socialist. But socialism itself functions as a kind of religion. So in a strange way, their mindset is a little bit like Belloc's also. Their heathens are the enemies of socialism. Third, where libertarians cannot understand that men can act in the service of a higher purpose, it reduces individuals to their animal passions, which is the natural end result of a way of seeing the world that can only see the satisfaction of wants and basic needs. This has been called the reign of quantity by René Guénon. And because of this, libertarianism cannot discern what he calls quality, not only between competing belief systems, but also between individuals, since their various wants and satisfactions are treated as being equal no matter who they are. The wants and satisfactions of a scumbag are the same in theory as the wants and satisfactions of a heroic warrior or a monk. This, again, is radically leveling. Milton Friedman often talked of the market being the most natural democracy, since individuals can vote things in and out of existence with their wallets. But this gives the scumbag, the follower, the weak person, the coward, and so on, as much of a say as those individuals of superior quality. The lone exception to this is the entrepreneur. But this is only because he is judged on the material output he can provide to everyone else, which is to say, he makes things that people want. The entrepreneur then, if successful, earns the right to greater riches for himself, because this is what he gets in exchange for his material service to everybody else. But who do scumbags, cowards, and weak people elevate to such positions of success? By voting with their wallets. And what sorts of products do these people make? I want to move on now to consider a test case. Meet the village blacksmith. Let's call him John Smith. This chap is a local master blacksmith in the pre-industrial age. His father, John Smith, was also a master blacksmith, and his father before him, John Smith, was also a master blacksmith. And he expects that his son, little John Smith, pictured here, will also be a master blacksmith. The furthest John Smith has ever travelled is to a market fair at the nearest local town. But for most of his days, John Smith has lived in this village. Now, John Smith enjoys some protections. The sale of foreign iron goods has been strictly prohibited by the king. Furthermore, John Smith is a member of the Blacksmiths Guild. This means that he is the only person allowed to practice smithing in this village. If local farmers want to get some horseshoes, they must go to John Smith. For this reason, he seldom changes his prices much. If his suppliers of steel and iron increase their prices, his prices go up. If they drop down again, he can afford, in the interests of honesty and fairness to his good friends who buy his products, drop them down again. In fact, the guild has rules in place that forbid John Smith from making illicit profits from his products, or indeed from dropping them down so low that people from other villages would travel to his smith rather than buying from their local guild member. So he does not have much leeway here in any case. But even if these rules were not in place, it is not in John Smith's nature to seek more. He is happy making an honest living. Will he ever branch out and get a second shop? No. Will he ever make wildly more money than he does already? No. But this is not John Smith's purpose. His purpose is to sell horseshoes and tools in the local community. And this makes him fulfilled, as it made his father and his father before him fulfilled. As it will fulfill little John Smith, his son. It is what God wants. It is what his local lord wants. It is what the guild wants. It is what the king wants. So be it. All is good with the world. John Smith will live and die in this village, never dreaming of more. Now, to the liberal mindset, much of this is repugnant. First, why should John Smith's little son be a blacksmith too? What if little John wants to be something else? What if little John wants to become a scholar, or a painter, or a dancer, or a singer? What if little John wants to express himself and be more than a mere blacksmith? This seems fundamentally unfair. There's no social mobility for little John. Justice for little John. Note that this is not the socialist speaking, but the libertarian. Little John and his father exist in a state of genuine unfreedom by the libertarian definition. And this in itself feels wrong to the libertarian. Little John is trapped inside a caste system. I'll just note in passing that this is yet another way in which libertarian thought is radically egalitarian. The mindset of John Smith simply accepts that little John is of a particular caste. He is simply a type of person who will be a blacksmith. He's of blacksmith stock. Why wouldn't he be a blacksmith? As distinct from a peasant or his lord or a priest. It is what God wants. It is what the king wants. It is what the lord wants. And it is ultimately what John Smith and what little John want. So be it. Amen. But the liberal mind cannot handle this. It sees only individuals here. the son of John Smith may be better suited to being something else. Also, why should the son of the Lord get to be the Lord? What's he done to deserve it? It's so unfair. So, in the libertarian worldview, the situation on the left here just won't do. This is not only radically egalitarian in the vertical sense, the axis with the Lord at the top and the peasant at the bottom, but also in the much less discussed horizontal sense, in which the libertarian is displeased with the idea that people should not be able to pick their own jobs along a continuum of jobs of roughly equal social standing. Why should little John be a blacksmith? Maybe he wants to be an actor or a scholar or any number of other things. I would like to suggest in 2021 that most people dislike the pressure and uncertainty of not knowing what they will do in their lives, and that there are significant costs imposed by the freedom to choose. I wonder how much anxiety is induced by people feeling that they never found something they were good at, that they never found their niche in life, that they never achieved what they wanted to. And this is the downside of the freedom. I wonder how many would exchange the pressure and the uncertainty and the anxiety for the static but relatively safe and stable situation of little John. It is a question to be asked, but there can be no doubt about which side of this issue the libertarians must be on. And on all of these matters, the socialists are largely in full agreement. I mean, after all, why should little John be denied the chance of becoming a cross-dressing porn star? Anyway, even beyond the life choices of little John, there are more liberal objections to this situation. What about the money being left on the table by John Smith? Where's his ambition? If it were not for the restrictions and the price controls put in place by that awful blacksmith's guild, he might max out his profits and finally expand his smithery. Possibly he might open a second branch in a nearby village. The competition would do the neighbouring blacksmith good. Also, think about the technological stagnation induced by this arrangement. John Smith is using practically the same tools as his grandfather. There have been virtually no gains in the productive output of this smithery for decades. It's a study in stagnation. It has been a supra-marginal firm for over 100 years, just about turning over enough money to feed this man's family and little more. It's a disaster. There's no capital investment. Furthermore, if the guild was abolished and these stupid restrictions were removed, we might finally see some economies of scale. The smithery might be replaced by the factory, which can produce many more iron and steel products at a reduced per unit cost, greatly increasing output. Everyone would be better off for this. Everyone. And if John Smith finds himself put out of business, perhaps his and little John Smith's talents could be put to better, more productive uses. And even beyond that, what about this total ban on foreign iron goods? Perhaps another country can make even more goods at a lower price again, and everyone will benefit further. I would now like to put the theoretical libertarian argument, and for this let's use Mises, who would definitely make these arguments against the traditionalist, and then let's use Thomas Carlyle, who would definitely have opposed these arguments, as our banner cases. Mises, I'm going to put the pro arguments for abolishing the guild and the foreign import ban into the mouth of Mises, while Carlyle will make the anti arguments. Mises would argue along these lines. He would say abolishing the guild and the foreign import restrictions would, one, reduce the prices of iron goods benefiting everyone. Two, it will greatly increase the efficiency of the production process. Three, it will greatly increase the range and the total amount of iron goods produced. 4, it will enhance technology, thereby freeing up labour to be put to more productive uses, which can then make more goods in other areas, for example. And 5, these changes will enhance the comfort and the quality of life for all, leading people like John Smith to live longer and to have more material wealth. Hurrah! Now, to this, one can imagine Thomas Carlyle flying into a fit of rage. He'd practically have a seizure, and he'd argue along these lines. 1, it will condemn poor John Smith and his family and all similar blacksmiths across the country to a life of abject nomadism, thereby removing the certainty, security, and sense of spiritual fulfillment their calling as a master blacksmith gave them. 2, it will disrupt the village way of life that has endured for centuries and sever forever the social bonds that tied these people together in a community. The bond between John Smith and his friend. The bond between John Smith and his fellow guild members, as well as the bond between John Smith and his local lord, and beyond that, the bond between the people of the nation and the king. 3, it will take away the dignity and the pride of the master blacksmith, who must now be condemned to work as a mere factory labourer. 4, it will reduce the quality of goods, which will now be the product of ghastly mass industrial processes rather than made lovingly by the master blacksmith. And 5, the material gains, the gains in material wealth and health, are mere trinkets celebrated by bean counters. Puh. These gains cannot offset the spiritual loss. In the long run, people will lament what has been lost forever. Mark my words. Now, it's ultimately up to you to decide whose arguments you are more persuaded by. But it is my contention that the libertarian arguments here are predicated on egalitarian and materialist principles, which are the result of pure rationalism, whereas those on the side of Carlyle are predicated on transcendent, anti-rationalist and idealist notions that simply cannot be quantified with a total acceptance of hierarchy and even caste baked in to his assumptions. Now, of course, one trick that libertarians have up their sleeves here is simply to redefine socialism as any opposition to the free market whatsoever, which would end up labelling the likes of Carlyle as a socialist or as a kind of socialist. In fact, the aforementioned Hans Hermann Hoppe does just this in his book A Theory of Socialism and Capitalism in the chapter The Socialism of Conservatism. Now, Hoppe has some different positions later on when he came to reject the Whig view of history, but here we find him peddling that view of history to some extent. I think there's an interesting moment in this chapter in which we find the younger Hoppe struggling with the natural right-winger within himself and coming to terms with the fact that he might be peddling absolute horseshit. Let's read a bit of it, and I will comment as we go on. He says, roughly speaking, before the 18th century in Europe and throughout the world, a social system of feudalism or absolutism, which was in fact feudalism on a grander scale, existed. In abstract terms, the social order of feudalism was characterized by a regional overlord who claimed ownership of some territory, including all of its resources and goods, and quite often also all of the men placed upon it, without having originally appropriated them himself through use or work, and without having a contractual claim to them. On the contrary, the territory, or better, the various parts of it and the goods standing on it, had been actively occupied, used and produced by different people before the natural owners. The ownership claims of the feudal lords were thus derived from thin air. Now, note that his description thus far has been purely materialist, and he reduces the profound medieval belief in the great chain of being to thin air. Centuries of accumulated wisdom dismissed and delegitimated in two words. Let's continue. Hence, the practice based on these alleged ownership rights of renting land and other production factors out to the natural owners in return for goods and services, unilaterally fixed by the overlord, had to be enforced against the will of these natural owners by brutal force and armed violence, with the help of a noble caste of military men who were rewarded by the overlord for their services by being allowed to participate and share in his exploitative methods and proceeds. For the common man, subject to this order, life meant tyranny, exploitation, economic stagnation, poverty, starvation, and despair. Note that this is merely asserted by Hopper, and if you follow up his sources, you'll find that the French Annales school historian Marc Bloch and the explicitly Marxist Trotskyite historian Perry Anderson, one of the leading figures in the British New Left in the 1970s and the 1980s, are his sources. And also Rodney Hilton, another explicitly Marxist historian and a member of the New Left. Thus we see, when it comes to challenging the old order in the service of liberalism, Hopper, at least in the early 1990s, thought nothing of drawing on the Marxist progressive vision of history to weave a narrative. But is it true that the peasantry lived under quote-unquote tyranny, exploitation, economic stagnation, poverty, starvation, and despair? Well, let's read on. He says, as one might be expected, there was resistance to this system. Interestingly enough, though, from the present day perspective, it was not the peasant population who suffered most from the existing order, but the merchants and traders who became the leading opponents of the feudal system. Hold on. It wasn't the peasants who suffered most from, quote, tyranny, exploitation, economic stagnation, poverty, starvation, and despair? What? Come again? They were living under tyranny and despair, but it was the merchants and the traders who suffered most. Does that pass the sniff test? Does that sound coherent? Let's continue. Buying at a lower price in one place and travelling and selling at a higher price in a different place, as they did, made their subordination to any one feudal lord relatively weak. They were essentially a class of international men crossing the borders of various feudal territories constantly. As such, in order to do business, they required a stable, internationally valid legal system, a system of rules valid regardless of time and place, defining property and contract, which would facilitate the evolution of the institutions of credit, banking, and insurance essential to any large-scale trading business. Naturally, this caused friction between the merchants and the feudal lords as representatives of various arbitrary regional legal systems. The merchants became feudalism's outcasts, permanently threatened and harassed by the noble military caste attempting to bring them under control. In order to escape this threat, the merchants were forced to organize themselves and help establish small fortified trading places at the very fringes of the centers of feudal power. As places of partial extraterritoriality and at least partial freedom, they soon attracted growing numbers of the peasantry running away from feudal exploitation and economic misery, and they grew into small towns, fostering the development of crafts and productive enterprises which could not have emerged in the surroundings of exploitation and legal instability characteristic of the feudal order itself. This process was more pronounced where the feudal powers were relatively weak and where power was dispersed among a great number of often very minor rival feudal lords. It was in the cities of northern Italy, the cities of the Hanseatic League and those of Flanders, that the spirit of capitalism first blossomed and commerce and production reached their highest levels. But this partial emancipation from the restrictions and the stagnation of feudalism was only temporary and was followed by reaction and decline. This was due in part to internal weaknesses in the movement of the new merchant class itself. Still, too much ingrained in the minds of men was the feudal way of thinking, in terms of different ranks assigned to people, of subordination and power, and of order having to be imposed upon men through coercion. Hence, in the newly emerging commercial centres, a new set of non-contractual regulations and restrictions, now of bourgeois origin, were soon established. Guilds that restrained free competition were formed, and a new merchant oligarchy arose. More important, though, for this reactionary process was yet another fact. In their endeavour to free themselves from the exploitative interventions of various feudal lords, the merchants had to look for natural allies, and we will stop there. I'd like to suggest here that the reason the system kept reverting back to the older order was not because the people had to be, quote, coerced into it, but rather because, as Hopper himself notes, there was an ingrained belief system which, far from being artificially maintained by force, was in fact natural and normal. Little John Smith was quite fulfilled in his feudal life, and things worked in harmony before those pesky merchants turned up and started to change everything. And this is something that Hopper himself realised partly when he came to write Democracy, the God That Failed, and in the essays that make up the first part of The Great Fiction. He realised that the foundations of liberalism and its origin story, so to speak, were built on a lie. But Hopper was practically expelled from polite libertarian circles thereafter and denounced by Jeffrey Tucker, who has since gone on to write hit piece after hit piece on important right-wing thinkers such as the aforementioned Carlyle and Julius Evola, making sure to label them as fascists in his titles. But if you read those pieces, I think they belie a fundamental shallowness and emptiness in Tucker's own thought, incapable of even understanding where these men were coming from, which, if nothing else, is a failure of intellectual imagination. Hopefully, this video and the preceding two have given everyone a lot to chew on. I am pleased that the first two videos have stirred quite a lot of debate. I have noted that they have upset some people who see this as something of a betrayal. Please understand, I am not making this series to be destructive or to turn on libertarians or anything like that, but rather to sum up my thoughts on how we've ended up where we are right now. We need to come to terms with the fact that the left keep winning and something isn't right. It's in that spirit that I offer these critiques. I recognise many libertarians are friends and not enemies. I have agreed to discuss this further on a stream with Radical Liberation next week, hopefully on his weekly Econ Chat stream, but details are to be decided. In the meantime, let me know what you think. I greatly appreciate your comments and I do try to read them all. Thanks for watching.
Are you sick of hearing about Marx and Keynes? Do you want to know why neoclassical economics is so flawed? Have you ever wondered how to work out the marginal productivity of a burger bun? Do you want to level up your econ knowledge? Buy it now. £350. Foundations of Economics. Foundations of Economics.
I'm here.
Foundations of Economics. Get it now. Be sure to like this video and subscribe. And if you really like my content, maybe consider joining the channel or donating or maybe even buy a mug. I am grateful for all of your support. Now get out.